Hello, Front Stretch faithful. This is episode 7 of the 2015 Front Stretch podcast. As usual, I am Matt Stalnick, your host, and joining me for the 7th time this season is my good buddy Mike Neff. Sunday's race was contested at Michigan International Speedway, and for the 2nd time this season, the high drag package, which was born out of the NASCAR R&D Center, was used. Matt Kenseth won the race in dominating fashion and was never seriously challenged during the race outside of a short mid-race charge by Austin Dillon, who had a very good run in his own right. The race itself was a farce, to say the least, as the package essentially prevented drivers from making passes due to dirty air, even worse than it did at Indianapolis, which is where the package was raced originally. And the package as a whole was ultimately deemed a failure by pretty much everyone who matters in the sport, including NASCAR officials themselves, such as Steve O'Donnell. So, Mike, we obviously know what we're going to talk about today. This high drag experiment is now in the books. Please give me your take first on the race, which I'm quite sure you know where it's going to be, and more importantly, where you think the sport is headed from here in the wake of this experiment.
I'm on board with everybody else. The race was pretty much an abject disaster. Restarts were fun,
yeah,
but restarts are fun pretty much every week. And even on that, I don't know that we saw cars passing as much as we normally do. There were a couple exceptions. Martin Truex seemed to be able to move through the field pretty well. Dale Earnhardt Jr. even was able to make some decent ground for a while. But then he got pretty far back in there, and at that point he was pretty much done as well. But the only real car all weekend was Kenseth, and like you mentioned, Dillon had a good run there at one point when he got up front. But again, I think that was like everybody. As long as they were close to the front, they could kind of do what they wanted to. But you still couldn't pass. In looking at the race and reviewing the data afterwards just to make sure I was right, outside of lead changes that occurred because it was a restart, there were zero on-track passes for the lead. And I don't know that I remember a race in the last 5 years anyway where there was not one on-track pass for the lead outside of a restart.
There were a few that have come close.
It was terrible. Yeah. It really was. And I was disappointed. I mean, we talked about this last week that we were anticipating the potential for a good, exciting race, and I'm not convinced it was just the package. I still feel like part of it is on the drivers. I mean, when the race started, there was maybe room for two grooves, and as Jeff Burton noted on the broadcast, when you get down there close to the white line, you really lose banking, and it can be really hard to be that far down there. So at the start of the race, I could understand that they didn't want to sail it in there side by side. But by the time we got to the halfway point, the groove was moved up enough that you could go three wide comfortably through the corners. And I just felt like guys weren't trying to get to the outside of people and make stuff happen. I don't know if they felt unstable and they just didn't want to push it. I mean, I think that's a problem that I've had so much with this package since the car tomorrow, in the grand scheme of things, they talk about how they drive it and how they're on the edge. How many cars actually spin out? I mean, Tony Stewart and Jimmy Johnson spun on this weekend, but if it's that on the edge of being out of control, why are we not having 10 and 12 cars spinning every race? And we have a lot of races go down where there's one or two cautions for actual incidents with cars. So part of me is wondering if the drivers are truly on edge as much as they claim they are.
I don't think they are, personally. I mean, the cars look pretty stuck to the track. I mean, I get that there's smaller, you know, more minute level handling differences that they're going to obviously feel and see, that they're going to complain about more, that don't come across the viewer well. You see that a lot at restrictor plate tracks. You know, it looks like they're stuck to the track, but they're actually dealing with some handling issues. So, I'm not in the car, so I can't really make that judgment. But yes, I think that it was definitely interesting that the drivers were complaining about being so loose, but no one actually really spun. As far as the race itself, I don't know what more needs to even be said about it. It was obviously a failure. We were very excited, you know, in the weeks leading up to this, I think for good reason, because I think as we noted before, the idea was born out of a goal that I think was very noble, and a goal that was very, I think, achievable if they could have, you know, hit the package differently. I think the ideas that were behind the package were sound. It just wasn't executed well. I mean, what stuck out to me the most was, the more I've had a chance to digest it, is I think this high drag package could have worked if they lifted the fronts of the cars off the ground. I really do. I mean, they probably would have had to lift a little bit more because you're losing some of that front downforce. But you probably still would have maybe had some pack speed just because of how strong the rear drag was. And there's any number of ways that could have went. Maybe they would have gone full throttle even with the cars off the ground. I don't know. But it seemed to me that this package could have been designed a little bit better. And I'm not saying that from the perspective of, oh, we just needed low downforce. No, like, if you want to try the high drag style package, I think it could have worked if they gave up some of the problems that have plagued some of these other packages that we've tried. I mean, even with a low downforce package, these cars are still stuck to the ground. And that is just a huge issue as far as front downforce goes, because I don't even think rear downforce has been the big issue as far as these aero problems. I think it's really a front downforce issue, and it seems like that's the part of the car that NASCAR has been the least willing or able to address. Now, I'm not the kind of person who's going to sit there and say that, oh, there's, you know, I don't know why they don't do it. I don't really know why they don't haven't addressed it yet. I'm sure there's a good reason, but
I disagree. I've been harping that wagon for years now, brother, and I can't get anybody to give me a good reason.
Well, I can't either. That's why I'm curious. I mean, I there's got to be some reason why, because it seems intuitively obvious to anyone who gains any sort of understanding of these cars that you got to get that front lifted off the ground. The only thing that I can think of before we segue is that it must be something to do with the teams, I guess, maybe have tricks to get the car back on the ground some way during the race at all times, so NASCAR doesn't feel like they should bother with. I don't know.
As I've said, you cut everything below the front bumper off of it, they're not going to be able to get it all the way to the ground.
Well, that's, yeah, I agree. And so I don't know. And it's very frustrating, because I think you could probably have a much more satisfying form of pack racing on a place like Michigan if you just cut the frickin' front bumper off. But, you know, they're learning. That's kind of the only takeaway you can take from a weekend like this, is that they're learning. And it really, from people I've talked to now in the industry as of the past month or so, it sounds like the drivers have a bigger voice than they ever have, and they're really actually in NASCAR's ear, and NASCAR is actually finally listening for once. And I think this was the last thing NASCAR really wanted to test before they finally just committed themselves to going with this low downforce route. I don't see any reason why the low downforce wouldn't be the route going forward, and I think that's the best thing that could have come out of this race, is that this high drag, I shouldn't say high downforce, because from what I've been told, this high drag package actually had less downforce than the original 2015 package. Don't ask me how. But this high drag style thing, I think there's some good ideas with it, but I think for the time being, it needs to be shelved until we really iron out this low downforce package, get that worked out well at all these other tracks, get the racing set from there, get us back to, you know, mid-2000s levels of racing, and then maybe start trying to add even more exciting elements to the package from there. I think Brian France's goal of getting drafting at these tracks is noble, but I think for the right now, get the cars handling right, get the aero push thing figured out first, then figure out how to put drafting on top of that at the intermediate tracks. I think that's really the only strategy from here.
Yeah, I think if you get the nose off the ground, you'll have drafting.
I
really
too.
Do. And the bottom line is, we've got to get them to where they have to not only lift, but use the brakes to make these cars go through the corners. And then, until we get to that point, you're going to end up with snoozers like we had this weekend. We got to have it to where they're lifting for an extended period of time, and even better than that, having to use the brakes to get the car slowed down the turn.
I'm trying to think of the last time that we even had braking at intermediate tracks. I don't even know if, for as long as I've been watching, if braking was ever a part of intermediate track racing, at least in my era. And I started watching around 97, 98. And I don't – maybe deep into runs. Like, deep into runs in the early 2000s at places like Charlotte, and especially, like, a place like Atlanta. You'd get guys, I think, probably tapping those brakes a little bit. I don't necessarily know if we need braking, but you need to get off the throttle a lot more. And you got to get these aero issues straightened out.
Absolutely.
So, you know, like I said, that's interesting. That's a fun discussion for another day. Because, man, that'd be interesting to see braking. I don't know if it's the first thing I would want to see, but, yeah, that's an interesting discussion. Because I can think of a time when I've seen that at any track other than maybe Darlington or smaller.
Yeah, I mean, I know I've seen telemetry at Atlanta, at least, and maybe even a little at Texas.
Maybe some trail braking.
They would trail brake it a little bit, and I know Jimmy Johnson has always said that he uses the brakes all the time on those kind of courses to set the nose as he goes into the corner.
I was going to say it would be helpful to set the nose a little bit, get the car settled, and that way you can set up your exit.
And that's what A.J. Foyt said that back in his Indianapolis days when he was still really competitive, that he hit the brakes every time he went into the corner at Indianapolis to get that nose set onto the ground and lead into his corners. And something that maybe some other drivers have picked up since then. I know I see it on telemetry sometimes. But, yeah, just something has to be done to where they can't just – I mean, literally, there were people that did not lift in qualifying, and that's just totally unacceptable.
Yeah, I mean, the only way that's going to be acceptable is if you don't have any aero push to at least – you know, spread the field out. If you're going to do wide open style racing, I think there's a place for it, but you can't be dealing with any aero issues if you're going to do it. It's got to be just straight up pure racing at that point. Can't be dealing with any aero problems if you're going to have wide open stuff. So, who knows? I think that the biggest takeaway is that I think low downforce at this point is pretty much a given is for 2016. I mean, I don't know if any of you folks who listen to SiriusXM religiously caught the earlier Monday morning discussion with Steve O'Donnell. Steve O'Donnell is one of the communication officers for NASCAR. He's basically the main spokesperson these days for the sport. And he actually came on, I believe it was this particular Monday morning, and he basically said that, you know, NASCAR viewed the high drag package as a failure. So he came right out and said it, and I think that was really cool, and it was very brave NASCAR to come right out and say that, you know, hey, listen, that didn't work. He didn't say specifically where they were going to go from there, but the overtones of what he was saying made it sound like low downforce is going to be the move from here on out. And it just makes sense. So
yeah, my only fear is that they're going to go to restrictor plates at Fontana in Michigan, and I think that will be horrendous.
I've heard those rumors. I don't know how valid they are. I guess from my perspective, it would depend on the kind of racing it would actually produce. If it produced something that was actually similar to the racing in Daytona and Talladega, it wouldn't necessarily be the first thing I would want to see at Michigan, but I probably actually end up enjoying it, to be honest with you. But if it was like a New Hampshire kind of restrictor plate race from like 2000, I don't really actually think that would happen, though. I think if you actually did put a restrictor plate on at Michigan and paired it with the right aero package, it probably would be a decent show. As far as, you know, the purity aspect of using restrictor plates, that's obviously another discussion. I don't necessarily know if it would be the worst show in the world, as long as you didn't take too much horsepower out of it. I personally don't think that's something we're going to need to worry about. I just don't see that happening, especially with how much of an impact the drivers have these days on NASCAR's decision making. I just don't see them green lighting that. But hey, listen, anything could happen. And I know for a fact that this is not the first time that either track owners or team owners or NASCAR themselves have lobbied for restrictor plates at certain tracks. I know you probably remember this. Right after the original Wickerbill package came in the year 2000, which was right after Earnhardt won his last race, that race was viewed as a big success because they had the Wickerbill package, they had the bigger restrictor plate, the bigger spoiler. Led to a crazy race, one of the most competitive races at Talladega of all time. And Ed Clark, who is still the owner of Atlanta Motor Speedway, or not the owner, but track president, general manager. He lobbied for restrictor plates in that particular wicker bill package to come to Atlanta. And I think they set up a feasibility test or something, but the whole thing ended up getting caught up in red tape and it never ended up coming to fruition. And NASCAR said they didn't want to do it. So this discussion has been going on for a while at some of the bigger, faster tracks. So it could happen. I don't think it would be the end of the world just because it's only two more tracks. And I think those are the only two tracks where it would ever be considered or it would ever – those are the only two tracks where it would possibly even work at. So if we get restrictor plates at Michigan, if it worked out well, I wouldn't mind it. It wouldn't be the first thing, like I said, I'd want to see. But if that's what it comes to put on a good race there, I guess that's what it comes to. I don't think we have to worry about that, though.
I hope not.
What do you think, though, of – where this package is going to lead us in 2016? Where do you see this whole thing unfolding now? You're pretty convinced it's going to be low downforce, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah, I mean, unless we go to Darlington and it's just a total cluster, I don't see how they get away from low downforce as the primary package for 2016. I still worry that for Pocono, Indy, Michigan, and Fontana, they're going to try to come up with some kind of wicker bill package that slows them down but doesn't get the nose off the ground. And I still think as long as you're slowing them down but not getting the nose off the ground, you're going to have what you had this weekend.
Yeah, so, I would have to agree. I mean, I'm cool with them messing with that stuff, but do it right.
And one of these days I'm going to get Stefanishin in a corner in a garage and hold a lit cigarette to his eye and get him to explain to me why they won't cut the stuff below the bumper off and at least try it.
One thought that came to my head the other day, actually it was today, and we'll end with this particular topic on this, is I often wonder if the engine in chassis manufacturers, you know, Chevy, Ford, Toyota, had some say in the look of these cars. They obviously have a say in how the cars look. And that would tell me that they probably have their ear in Stefanishin and basically kind of giving him some guidelines as to how these aero packages are going to look on the cars. And I can't help but wonder if, given the fact that today's cars are sleeker, they're more streamlined, they're more aerodynamic looking, I often wonder if the manufacturers have had some say in making these cars, you know, high downforce looking machines. Something I'd be willing to throw out there. I don't know how you feel about that, but it's something that
I know there's definitely input from the manufacturers as far as the look of the cars. And like you said, somewhat of how the stance of the car on the track. But again, we don't have splitters on street cars.
Right.
And that's where I still think I got into that with Brett Bodine a couple years ago at Daytona. And he's like, look at the front of that car. It's got all sorts of stuff below the bumper. I'm like, the stuff's not sitting on the ground. I said, and that's where our problem lies. But again, I keep beating that dead horse. One of these days, we're finally going to get somebody to try it. Hopefully it'll work.
I think we're at a breaking point, personally.
If they try it and they all go into turn one and plow it into the wall, we'll just be in bigger trouble.
Well, I think we're at a breaking point, and I think that this weekend was the breaking point, so to speak. And I think that it's important. The bubble has popped, and I think that a new direction is finally going to take over the sport. Maybe that's just the optimist in me that's saying that, but I think every indication at this point is that a crescendo has been reached in that capacity. Now, looking forward towards this weekend, we have Bristol coming up. And personally speaking, I know you and I are actually very much on the same page about this. The new version of Bristol, and I say new because I am not referring to the quote-unquote new Bristol, which was the original repave that happened in 2007. Rather, I'm referring to the second repave that happened in 2012, which has produced the Bristol that we have now. My opinion, it's put on some good shows over the past 2 or 3 years. Essentially, what used to be a bottom feeder racetrack is now a top feeder racetrack instead of really a multi-groove track. I personally think it's put on some good shows. But I'm curious to get your thoughts on what you think is going to happen this weekend. It's a big race as far as the chase implications go. It's a big race as far as excitement is concerned, simply because this is one of the few opportunities we're going to have for quite a while to have a slam dunk race, really. So what's your prospective forecast for what we're going to see this weekend in the Bristol Night Race?
I think we'll see a lot of side-by-side racing on a half-mile track, which I think is fantastic. I'm curious to see what the stands look like. I was actually speaking with a friend today asking if they were going to come to the race, and they said no, they couldn't get tickets. It was sold out.
Oh.
I have not heard of such a thing, and I find that kind of hard to believe, but that's what they told me. I think they may have just been making an excuse because they didn't want to come. But it's going to be an enormous weekend for Clint Bowyer. I think this is
one
race that could easily be won by somebody who has not won so far. Tony Stewart and actually Ricky Stenhouse Jr. coming to mind.
I would throw David Reagan in there, too. Got an
both of them
there
have had
today.
Strong runs in the last couple years even at Bristol when they weren't very good at other tracks. And so I think that's a definite possibility. In the end, it comes down to I hope we see tire wear to a point where tires make a difference. I don't know that we're going to, but I hope we will. And as long as we get that, I think it'll be a great race. I don't know that we'll see a lot of wrecks because we just don't see a lot of wrecks anymore, and you don't have to move somebody to get by them. But I think it'll be an awesome race. I don't know if the fans will love it. The race fans will love it, but the casual fans probably won't.
Yeah, that's kind of, I think, where we're at now as far as Bristol is concerned. I think that the newest iteration of Bristol is definitely, I think, a lot more well received than that first repave was. This new version isn't quite a full, you know, return to that old style beat and bang in Bristol. But we've had some races here which have come pretty close to that in a different way, obviously, around the top of the track. It's produced some good beating and banging. It's produced some good racing. It's not quite where it used to be. I think it's a good compromise between the two. I say that because I think that the next time they repave the track 10, 20 years from now, they're probably going to end up repaving it back into the original configuration. Just because that's what Bruton Smith does. For right now, I think it's been a track since 2012 that has kind of been hit or miss as far as producing old Bristol style action. Me personally, I love the new Bristol, the new version of Bristol. I like that it kind of combines elements of old and new, and I like that they can race side by side. I think personally, it's the best track on the circuit. That's just me. I've always been a fan of the track, old and new. So I think that there's a lot of guys this weekend who really need to step up. This is, in my view, the only shot that the field has to win one over the usual suspects. There's about four or five guys that I'm looking at who I think have a very legitimate shot at stealing a win in this race. Like you said, Stenhouse is one that really comes to mind. That would be a heck of an upset if that were to actually happen.
That would be. And the funny thing, when Stenhouse did it, he's still on the bubble at possibly falling out of the top 30. I think that would be a whole new twist on things if Stenhouse ended up winning this race
and then, just
and then
the bottom
fell out of the top 30 by the time we got done at Richmond.
Yeah, he's one who I could very easily see winning. I interrupted you a little bit earlier. I think David Reagan is somebody who I could conceivably see stealing a win. He actually, I think, got a top 10 here in the 2013 race driving for Front Row Motorsports. Off the top of my head, I know he had a nationwide win here in 2009. And he actually was a top 5 car here in the spring race before he got caught up in a wreck. It was obviously with Joe Gibbs Racing, but that team has really been running a lot better as of late, as has Bowyer's team. Bowyer's a good short track racer. He's got to be somebody who you imagine is going to be a threat to really step up this weekend and hope maybe win this thing. Another one that we haven't mentioned is Casey Kane. Casey Kane won here in 2013. He is usually somebody that is in the mix, especially at this new version of Bristol. It fits his style, I think, a little bit better. The track almost drives like a dirt track now, with that high line and that high groove, and got a little bit more space to work. That's kind of a Casey Kane style racetrack. This could be the weekend that Kane, I think, maybe redeems himself a little bit. I would mention Jeff Gordon usually, but to be honest with you, Gordon hasn't really been all that impressive at Bristol. To be honest with you, in the past 8 or 9 years, really.
I was going to say 6 to 7 anyway.
Yeah, I mean, really, since they repaved it, he hasn't gotten much of a handle. I do remember the 2011 race. He was pretty strong, which was a really boring race, by the way, now that I'm thinking about it. That was like one of the last ones before they repaved it a second time. But Gordon, I don't know if I see that happening, and that's a separate story. He could prove me wrong, but yeah, I think that this is going to be a weekend where we actually do see somebody else step up, because
Kyle Larson's probably going to be in the mix too, because
I forgot about him.
Races like a dirt track, he's run well there.
He's almost won here,
both Cup and Xfinity, so I think he'll have a shot.
Certainly, I mean, this was kind of his coming out party track, I think, last year. And that Spring Bristol race, he very easily could have won the thing, as Stenhouse almost did. But Larson was really strong, led some laps in that race. There's a very good opportunity for him to step up. I look at it as a wild card race. I look at the Bristol Night Race nowadays the same way that I look at Daytona, Talladega, Watkins Glen, Sonoma. It is a wild card track as far as how pit strategy ends up working out, and just you have the craziness of short track racing. You get comers and goers. If you get lucky, you miss some wrecks, you're there towards the end, pit strategy's right, and you do your best job to hold the field off towards the end, I think that just about anybody in decent equipment could conceivably win this race this weekend. And that's always exciting, especially when you go to a short track. So,
and the other thing we're going to have to deal with all weekend is weather. There's predicting afternoon, evening thunderstorms starting tomorrow all the way through Monday.
So. Well, wouldn't that be an interesting irony that the Spring Bristol race, which is supposed to be a day race, ended up being a night race because of rain?
Night.
And then the night race at Bristol, which was supposed to be a night race, obviously, could conceivably be a day race. I hope that doesn't happen, but I mean, at least, you know, in this case, you have Sunday as the rainout date, but who knows? I try not to. I'm not a meteorologist, so I'm gonna stay away from the rain discussion. But I am interested that you mentioned the grandstands, the crowd, that it might be a sellout. This race has actually recovered, I think, quite a bit over the past 2 or 3 years. Ever since they repaved it, I know that the rhetoric from fans hasn't been quite as positive, but the Bristol Night Race specifically is much better attended the past 2 years, I would say, than it was in the years leading up to it. I know right around 2009, 2010, 2011, the stands of even the night race were not looking very good. And starting from like 2013 on, once it kind of looked like the track was starting to get a little bit of its bite back, it really seemed like it recovered. And it's really just the night race. The spring race has struggled really bad, but the night race is still a really big draw. And it's still, even today, still has that aura about it. I consider it a major. I don't know about you. I consider it to be one of the 3 or 4 most important races on the circuit. And that's why I really do hope that we get a really slam dunk of a show. Because this is one of the most important races.
Mike Ciborini comes around once a month. He's the PR guy for Goodyear. And he does a little side project where he does an interview or a poll of 50 people from the garage and 50 people from the media, and puts together his results, whatever the questions may be. And the last poll he did was, what do you consider the 4 majors for the Cup Series? And his poll ended up being Daytona, Coca-Cola 600, Southern 500, and Indianapolis. And the Bristol Night Race was the 5th one in that list. And I had initially put that in there when I put my 4 together because I didn't think of the 600. And then when I reviewed my picks, I'm like, wait a minute, I forgot the 600. I swapped it out with Bristol, just because, you know, you get the purists that don't think we should be at Indy, and that's where you get that debate as to whether Indy should be in there or whether Bristol should be. But I completely agree that it's probably the first or second on the list as far as destination races.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you got Daytona 500. Bristol Night Race is probably the number 2 destination race, even though, you know, Indy and Darlington and Coke 600 are on the list as far as the majors.
I don't know if Darlington
Night
is a destination race anymore.
The Night Race is a happening. It's truly a happening, and I think that's where it and like you said, it suffered a downturn, but it rebounded quickly, where a lot of other places that have had downturns still haven't rebounded all the way.
Yeah, I really do. I think that if you actually ask people who go to that race nowadays, I think that you would probably get a more optimistic view of the racing. You can't really go by what you see on the internet, just because everybody who says anything on the internet is usually pretty negative, by law. But I think if you go by the eyeball test, the racing has been better. It's been a little bit more, how should I phrase this? Wreck happy, a little bit more bumping and beating. And I don't necessarily need that at Bristol to enjoy it, but I know a lot of other people do. So from that perspective, the racing has improved, if you want to call it that. And I think that the stands have really turned around. And it's definitely, I think, the second biggest destination race on the circuit. There was a point in time where I think it was number one. I think that you could make an argument that it was not necessarily more prestigious than the Daytona 500, but a bigger destination-style race than the Daytona 500 at one point. I don't think
it was a harder ticket.
Oh, yeah.
It was the hardest ticket in the sport for a long time.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, I've never actually been there. It's still, to this day, it's a dream of mine to go to that race. And that should tell you all you need to know about what Bristol still means to the whole, you know, to the circuit and to the fans and everything. So it's funny, you know, we'll end on this discussion about the majors. It's funny, as far as destination races go, I definitely consider Darlington a major, and this is relevant because we're going to be going to Darlington the week after. I don't know if I would consider it a destination race though anymore. It might be nowadays, because it seems like the PR has improved for that event, and now that they're kind of trying to make it this throwback night type thing. But I don't know if Darlington over the past 15 years has really been a destination. I think Daytona, Talladega, Bristol, as far as destinations on the circuit go, Indy was at one point. I unfortunately don't think most fans view it that way anymore. But I think outside of Daytona, Talladega, and Bristol, you don't have a fourth really true destination racetrack. But
yeah, I mean, Darlington, I think, struggled with it because they moved it off of Labor Day.
Yeah.
Honestly, you know, it seems petty that you would think any time you could go see the race, it shouldn't matter when it is. But just the steep history of it on Labor Day and it being the Southern 500, now that it's the only date. You know, when they had two dates, then you might have been able to even hem and haw on it a little bit. But when it's the only race run at the track, having it on Labor Day and truly going back to the roots, I think makes it more of a destination. And I'm with you. It's one of those things that there's so much history there. That's why I still feel like it's a destination track. Kind of like Charlotte. I mean, I think Charlotte's a bit of a destination track.
Yeah, I would say that. That I would agree.
Because of the history there too with the 600. But it's, I feel like now that we're back to Labor Day, there's a lot more buzz in the air about going to Darlington this year than there has been in the last 5 or 6 years.
Oh, I would go longer than that. I mean, I've been watching this. When I got into the sport, it was, all right, I think I first started watching around 97, 98. And back then, the major races every year were Daytona, number one, Indianapolis, number two, because Indy was a huge deal back then. Number three, I would probably put the Bristol Night Race. At number three, the Coke 600 was a major back then. And then pick a Talladega race, because that was a bigger deal back then as well. Beyond that, when I grew up, Darlington was kind of just another race. And it wasn't until I got a little bit older that I really started to understand the place of that particular circuit, why it was important for the fan base and for the sport itself. Because growing up, you know, Darlington races didn't strike me as being all that special. I didn't really understand, you know, just how difficult the track was, which is another big part of it. It's kind of like the Augusta National of NASCAR, so to speak.
Yeah, that's a nice analogy.
And nowadays, if you take a look at the schedule, Darlington is the second race of the NBC portion of the regular season. This one of only two races that gets NBC billing. It's the only race that's going to be on NBC. It's back on its traditional date now. And most importantly, I think, for that track, it's the only date at the circuit. There's only one race at Darlington now. And it seems like NASCAR is trying to push it back into being a major again, which I think is really cool because it has enough built-in history to be a major. It just becomes an interesting discussion that if they were to ever go through and give tracks official status of being a major or not, it makes me wonder where that would all fit into the framework, because it's kind of like a too many cooks kind of a situation now. You got Daytona, yeah. Charlotte, Indy, Bristol, Talladega, and Darlington. All of those, that's six tracks, and traditionally there was four majors, right? So you have six tracks that are essentially fighting for four majors. I personally think that if you go strictly by what people outside of the sport, how people outside of the sport view the sport, you know, casual fans, the mainstream media, the general populace, Talladega and Indy are both very important as far as that concerned. I would argue that Talladega and Indy are more important outside of the sport than Darlington is. Inside the sport, Darlington is a bit more important. Bristol is also a bit, would probably fall into that category as well, because Daytona, Indy, and Charlotte are pretty much locks as far as being a major goes. Yep. And I think it's really a toss-up between the other three. The fact that Talladega doesn't have one set major race, like it's, you know, one being like a 400-miler, one being a 500-miler, there's two 500-milers there. So it's impossible to pick one of those. That's really the only thing that I think disqualifies that, in my opinion. I would say just put five majors up. I think that there are five major events.
Yeah. I think it's, yeah, if you call it five majors, I would completely agree. I mean, you take the debate about Bristol and Darlington out of it. And again, Darlington's the little race that could, or the little track that could. I honestly feel like NASCAR tried to kill it.
They tried to move it
to Mother's Day. They wanted to see it fall on its face, and then they were going to be like, yeah, you know, that region just can't support it. We're going to move it to Vegas, or we're going to move it to wherever.
Well, they wanted Auto Club to be the next major.
Yeah.
That was very clear.
And it ended up that it didn't. They moved it to Mother's Day thinking it would be a bomb, and the place sold out. And it sold out for two or three years in a row. And then they ended up recently moving it off of Mother's Day, and it still succeeded. And so I think that cooler heads have prevailed, and that's why the obvious choice of putting it back on Labor Day happened. And like you said, I feel like they have gone from trying to kill it to embracing it, and that's where all this throwback stuff is coming from. Living down here in South Carolina now, there's been a ton of publicity. They've had cars at the governor's mansion. They've had all sorts of pre-race hype going on. But there's just, like I said, and it may be partly because I'm down this way a little bit further than I have been being in the Charlotte area. But there's a lot of buzz in the air about Darlington this year, and I'm excited about it. And that's honestly, you know, you mentioned that Bristol could be a race this weekend where it's a wild card or somebody steals one. Don't forget, Darlington can be the same way.
Yeah, no, definitely could.
Win for Furniture Row. You know, we've seen some situations there where people you didn't expect to be in there were in the mix. I doubt it. I still think it's going to be a Kyle Busch show, but it wouldn't surprise me. I wouldn't be shocked if, you know, take your pick, Austin Dillon or Kyle Larson or somebody like that, Jamie McMurray, popped up and won the race out of the blue. So it's I think it's a major just from the history of it. I mean, being the first super speedway and just its place in the sport. There's closest finish in history, and the largest margin of victory. Just there's been a lot of stuff that's gone on at that track. That's the reason we have window nets. You know, Richard Petty crashed there and about flew out of the car. That was when they put window nets into cars. I mean, there's a lot of tradition, and it's very ingrained in the roots and the foundations of the sport.
Yeah. I mean, the way I look at it nowadays is that you have five majors, which are, you know, Daytona, Charlotte, Indy, Darlington, and Bristol. And then I consider you have five more baby majors. That's kind of how I look at it, which are the championship race in Homestead, which is obviously very important. The two Talladega races, the Coke Zero 400, and Watkins Glen. That's basically how I sort of view it. If they were to ever make, you know, an official major thing. I think that's going to actually come back at some point. That's just an independent anecdotal thing of my own. But
I don't think I'd give two of them to Talladega. I mean, I'm cool with Talladega having one, but I think Richmond should be in there at some point in time.
Well, I mean, that's more unofficial. Because I just think that it's hard to pick one. I think both of those races have a lot of clout outside of the sport, which is a very important and underrated thing. But yeah, Richmond, that's important, especially that last Richmond race, for sure.
Yep.
But it's an interesting discussion. That's one that's probably never going to completely go away. But
no, you're probably right.
Very excited for Bristol this weekend. For all fans who want to tune in, coverage begins at 7:30 on the NBC Sports Network. I'm Matt Stalnick, signing off for this weekend's edition of the podcast. For Mike Neff as well. We'll see you next week, folks.
Peace out.